Welcome to the final episode of the second season of the RJOS podcast. I'm your host, Liana Tedesco. This season, we highlighted the winners of the He for She, the She for She, and the Courage Awards. It has been such an honor for me to connect with our guests, to learn about who they are and how they became our esteemed award winners, as well as what the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society means to them. We discussed the present and the future and how we, the listeners, can create a better and more equitable future for those interested in orthopedic surgery. My next guest is Dr. Seth Leopold. Dr. Leopold is an arthroplasty surgeon by trade, but in 2021, after 20 years of taking care of patients, he transitioned full-time to his role as the Editor-in-Chief of Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, or CORE, as well as CORE Relations, a near-daily, quick-hits electronic newsletter that helps efficiency-minded non-academic surgeons, many of whom find the journals too slow and insufficiently practical to cut through the clutter. Dr. Leopold has been involved with RJOS for many years, but even before his involvement, he has been a true advocate for women and one of our first winners of the He for She Award. Let's get to it. First and foremost, I would like to thank today's guest, Dr. Seth Leopold, for joining us today. Dr. Leopold, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here, and it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. So we're going to start this off. You're very well known in the orthopedic community, but for some of our younger listeners, can you tell them a little bit about who you are?
Well, that's generous. Thank you. My name is Seth Leopold. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm the editor-in-chief of a large general interest orthopedic journal called Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research. And we were actually the official orthopedic journal of the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society, which is a point of pride for me. We've had that relationship now for about 10 years. I think it might have been the first one that I created when I began as editor-in-chief, which is something else that makes me feel good. It's been an affiliation that we're proud of and very happy about. I'm also an orthopedic surgeon. I work at the University of Washington in an academic practice. I've been there for about 20 years. Before that, I was in academic practice in the military. That is, I helped to teach Army surgeons. My subspecialty was hip and knee replacement, although I don't operate anymore. Most of my time is spent these days on research and journal work. I still see unusual consults a few times a month for decision making.
And, you know, for someone who's a medical student who's thinking about orthopedics, tell us how you chose orthopedics and or how did you come to it?
That was a long time ago. I have to try to remember. I think it's a combination of things, probably not a hell of a different than too many other people. A combination of seeing people in the different specialties of medicine and the subspecialties of surgery and trying to decide who looks happy doing what they're doing. And it seemed like the orthopedic surgeons who I worked with looked happy to go to the office, and they looked happy to go to the operating room, and they enjoyed the contact with their patients. And I don't know if this was some kind of selection bias, but if they were very stressed out in the work they did, it didn't show. And it wasn't until I started doing it that I realized that it actually is kind of stressful sometimes. But the people who were my mentors wore it very well, and so were inspiring in that way. The work itself looked like fun. The patient populations were, at least the ones that I was exposed to when I was making those decisions, were, you know, gratifying. You know, the compare and contrast were, for me, some other surgical specialties. I was curious about cardiothoracic at one point because as I looked at them and watched them operate, they really seemed to have like the best hands in the hospital. And, you know, they could walk into an ICU room where everything is just coming apart at the seams. And, you know, they knew enough physiology to bring calm to the place and get the work done. But they didn't seem as friendly to me and they didn't seem as happy. And so I wasn't confident that I would have the ego strength to be friendly and happy, which was another goal of mine. After going through all the training that they went through, if I couldn't find an example of somebody in that profession who was, whereas a lot of the ortho guys, and they were mostly guys back then, a problem I'm sure we'll talk about today.
Sure, we'll get into it.
Yeah, we may touch on it at least tangentially. but they seemed pretty happy in their jobs, and that was something that appealed.
Yeah, I think that is a common thread, you know, for me and anyone I ever asked about why they picked orthopedics is everyone's super happy. And I think for the most part that is true. And in my training, I have mostly been happy. So I think that is a good thing to think about.
Yeah, happy is good.
It's important. I think there are a lot of things to consider when you pick your specialty out of medical school, but being happy is possibly the most important one, but easily overlooked.
Yeah, it can be missed. And, you know, one of the tricky bits, and now that I've got kids who are kind of making their way in the world, you know, there's sort of a difference between looking at the process of getting there and looking at what it looks like when you're there. And that can be hard, and it can dissuade, you know, depending, you know, on how arduous the path is. You know, so there's sort of a difference between becoming an orthopedic surgeon and being one, and becoming a cardiothoracic surgeon and being one. And there are some trade-offs there that probably are relevant, you know, probably are relevant, you know, and that's, I think that's also worth talking about or thinking about anyway, when one's making those decisions.
That's such a great point. Yeah, being an orthopedic surgeon and becoming one, you know, no one's residency is easy or particularly fun, and everyone's PGY2 year is hard. And so it's hard to forget that at the end of all of that, you get to be an orthopedic surgeon, and that's why you decided to do it.
Right. That's what to look at, for sure. But, you know, as bad as it might be for us, it's a heck of a worse for those poor souls in cardiothoracic.
Definitely a good point. as we talk about kind of making these big decisions, you know, can you think back, or even now, you know, who your most influential mentor has been, orthopedic or otherwise, and tell us a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah, what a great question. And more important than who my particular mentors are and were, would be, for whoever might be listening to this, is just the concept of making sure that you've got some at every stage. And I've been very fortunate to have them at every stage. And that's a combination of being lucky, and it's a combination of also knowing that I need mentorship and I need help and I need guidance, and my own temperament benefits from having somebody to admire and to try to emulate in various ways. And that was true in college and med school, or high school even. And it's equally true now, you know, when I'm trying to run a journal, and, you know, where I've run, you know, the orthopedic service line at a large university setting, you know, having mentors at each of those stages is important. You know, when I'm retired, I'm going to look for a good mentor in retirement, you know, to make sure that I get it right. You know, it's you know, people who've been down the path, are, it's really important to find them at each stage. I would say my best, most important orthopedic mentors have included Rick Mattson, who is the chair of my academic department when I got to University of Washington 20 years ago. He's no longer chair, but he's about 80, and he still operates every Tuesday and does a load that would, you know, put me flat on my back if I tried to do it. And he taught me about how to be a better partner, how to help partners when I was leading the group, how to articulate good values for whatever organization you're trying to run, and try to make decisions that are consonant with those values. But he also taught me a lot about being a dad and being a husband. I just enjoyed watching him model those activities with his family. He made me want to be a better person. There are other people on the list of people who made me want to be a better person. Josh Jacobs and Aaron Rosenberg were two men who I met during my fellowship. And they were probably 10 years down the road, you know, ahead of me. So youngish attendings, mid-career attendings when I was starting out. And each of them taught me something a little bit different about what kind of man I wanted to be, not just what kind of surgeon or what kind of physician, but what kind of man and what kind of person. And I, you know, I thank them for that. And, you know, my father was, not a physician, but I learned a lot from him about, you know, the kind of values that I want to express, whether that's hard work, not making excuses, you know, if I get something wrong, to say that I got it wrong and to say that I'm sorry. You know, that happens, you know, a good bit in both of my jobs, you know, whether it's the clinical work or the editorial work.
That's great. I think an important point for anyone is realizing that you change as your career evolves, as your life evolves, and the type of mentor you need may be different when you're a fourth year med student, an 18-year-old, 30-year-old, 50-year-old. There's a time and a place for different types of mentorship. So it's great to hear that you've had so many wonderful ones throughout your career.
Yeah, I've been fortunate that way. Actually, one other, I just realized how gendered that answer was, that there weren't any women on my list. But, you know, as I was coming up there, there weren't a whole ton of women, you know, senior attendings or anything else. But there was a young attending when I was a resident named Susan Sherrill. And I haven't crossed paths with her too much in post-residency life, but she gave me a book during residency that I read that changed what kind of physician I wanted to be. She gave me a book called Forgive and Remember by Charles Bosch. And it's a very thin book. You can read it in a weekend pretty easily, but it deals with a lot of the values that we should try to express and what happens when we don't express them. And we can talk more about the book if you want to, because I still do remember it. But one of the enduring messages I got from it was, by seeing some of the negative examples in that book, I came to realize how aggravating I was as a resident to my attendings. It made me want to change some of those habit patterns. So thanks to Dr. Sherrill for opening my eyes to that, not by telling me that I needed to change my aggravating habit patterns, but by just giving me a good book that helped me to think about it differently.
Tell me again the name of the book that she gave you.
It's called Forgive and Remember, and the author is Charles Bosch, B-O-S-K. And I was fortunate to get to interview him just a year or two before he died in CORE, in a section that we have in CORE called A Conversation With, where we interview people who are outside the profession, who are not physicians or usually doctors of any sort. You know, we've interviewed visual artists. I interviewed a cartographer, interviewed an astrophysicist, to get something from them that's relevant to surgery, but from a different vantage point. And because Charles Bosch's book was so influential on my own development as a physician, I thought it would be fun to interview, and we got lucky and were able to get the interview. And so that's in CORE. I can find that link for the podcast if it turns out that that's worthwhile here.
Oh yeah, we can definitely add that in. That would be great. I think I'd love to read that myself. That's very cool. Was that something that you started when you became the editor-in-chief of CORE, or was that always something that was part of it? I'm not sure about the history.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I did start that. So, you know, we changed CORE a lot when I began as editor. It used to be pretty much exclusively peer-reviewed articles, and I thought that if it's going to fully step into the ecologic niche in the info space, if you want, as a real general interest journal, the best general interest journals do more than just publish good science. I looked around at what I thought the most interesting general interest journals were, you know, Nature and Science and the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, were sort of the role models for me there. And some of the things that they did was they made sure to have a lot of commentaries on the articles so that even if you weren't a subspecialist in the area, you could gain from reading a commentary. They also have columns and other kinds of features. So we added columns and features. And one of the features we added, not right at the beginning, but I don't know, probably 5 or 7 years ago now, was A Conversation With, you know, with the idea that we ought to be able to learn. In fact, we can and need to learn from people who are different from ourselves.
That's going to kind of segue in a little bit to our next section, if you will, just talking a little bit about the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society and how did you learn about it? Because I think, you know, you made a good point of when you were coming up, and this is just, you know, historical, there were not that many women in orthopedics. So how did you learn about the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society?
Right. There weren't very many women in the specialty when I came up. And the sad problem is there aren't very many women in orthopedics now. And you know, that's to our detriment and to the detriment of our patients. I learned about Ruth Jackson from a close colleague. Obviously, I had been a fan of Ruth Jackson as you know, outside looking in for much longer than that, but I did not know that I could join until some years later. You know, I made the affiliation, I think, with Ruth Jackson, between CORE and Ruth Jackson in, I think, 2014, maybe. But I don't think I became a member until some years after that. I would have to check. When somebody said to me, gosh, you do all these things with Ruth Jackson, why, you know, why aren't you a member? And I said, I had no idea that I could be. But it was a happy day when I found that out, because I've enjoyed going to the meetings. It's let me get involved in other ways. You know, my favorite one being the mentorship program that you have. It's allowed me to get involved in the lives of many more people than I probably otherwise would. And also, as we've learned from the pandemic, you know, we don't have to be at the same institution to help people out. And so it's been fun to remotely mentor, if you like, or sponsor young women at places that are not where I work every day. And some of them I've never actually met in person, but have come to know very well.
That's great. I mean, I think that's just sort of the power of the technology we have now and the access people have, which is great. And being part of Ruth Jackson gives you entry into this network of people who care about, you know, making a difference within our field, which is great.
It's like so many other things that we get to do in life. You know, we get into these things thinking we're going to help other people, and we wind up getting so much more than we give. You know, the relationships with these young people have been really gratifying. And I think probably in the scheme of things have meant more to me than they have to them.
That's what they say about all this type of work, where you're going into it to help someone else and you end up being the one who is helped even more. Can you talk a little bit about CORE's partnership with Ruth Jackson and how that started and how it's developed since you've been involved?
Well, sure. CORE has a number of relationships with professional societies around the world, and some of them are societies that have a particular mission, such as the Ruth Jackson Society or the J. Robert Gladden Orthopedic Society, which we're also the official journal of. We are the official journal of some national societies around the world, as well as some specialty societies, like the International Society of Arthroplasty Registers is an example of that, or the Musculoskeletal Tumor Society, amongst many others. I think the number is a dozen or 15 altogether. And so, you know, I reach out to societies to try to create these affiliations for different reasons. Some because I think they have a really terrific meeting where important primary source research is presented. And I think that by having an affiliation like this, they could extend their reach as a journal and maybe do more good in the world. And then, you know, the journal would then have the privilege of packaging that up and being a part of something really nice pertaining to information dissemination, which is, you know, the business that we're in. But then there are other societies, and the Ruth Jackson Society is one of these, where it's not really about content dissemination. You know, the RJOS now is presenting some original research at its meetings, but it's not 1,000 papers. It's not a big scholarly meeting from that standpoint. So the relationship there is for other purposes. It's to try to enable something good to happen that both the journal and the society think ought to happen. So there we're looking for areas of mission overlap. And one of the chips I've carried on my shoulder really since my residency interview, and I've written about this before, when I was a med student interviewing for orthopedics and got strange questions about women in orthopedics, or strange questions in general, where the answer was women in orthopedics. You know, it's made me want to try to do what little I can to sort of make this better. You know, there just are not enough women in our specialty. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about why that might be, but the mission overlap, you know, that, which isn't exactly a journal's mission, I guess selfishly it's the editor's mission trying to work on this problem, made it appealing to get involved with RJOS on an official, you know, or a institutional level, I should say.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. I guess I'll ask you a question. Why do you think there aren't more women in orthopedics?
Well, you know, I should probably ask you that. You know, you probably know a great deal more about the stresses and the parts of our profession that don't appeal than I ever will. I'll take a whack at it since you asked. Honestly, I think it's still pretty sexist in a lot of ways. You know, each time I think that we are, I don't know that we're ever going to be all done with that part of our history, but each time I think that we're mostly done, something reminds me of the fact that we really aren't nearly done. You know, a few short years ago, there was that, I forget what it was. It was like a Google Drive list where men residents were ranking the appearance of women interviewees. And this made it, you know, a national stink where a lot of organizations did a lot of performative stuff, in my opinion, you know, trying to say how terrible and shameful this was and acted surprised when, you know, this thing really did circulate pretty widely. And the other thing that was especially wrenching to me about it was that it wasn't the old folks in our specialty doing it. This list was made and circulated by residents. These are young men, right? So whatever we think about that being behind us, their whole careers are still ahead of them. That made me sad. I think that there are structural problems, you know, and I wouldn't know this except for the work that I get to do at CORE, you know, reading people's papers where they summarize what's available and what's not available in terms of family leave or how challenging it is to, you know, to take advantage of family leave, the structure of residency programs. Somehow every other subspecialty seems to realize that women in their mid, late 20s, early 30s might want to start their families and make it possible and friendly to do that. And here it knocks you off the track. You're off a year, you know, God forbid you want to spend a little time with your child or even more, God forbid something happens to you and it's not a smooth recovery. I mean, you'd wind up losing your job, you know, or, you know, really being delayed. So I don't know, Dr. Tedesco, you know, what the real answer to your question is, but those are some of the things. I mean, it reminds me of the story I alluded to earlier, which is the last question and the worst interview I've ever had in my whole life was I was a med student interviewing for residency programs at a place I wanted to go. And the interviewer asked me what I thought the worst problem in orthopedics was. So this would have been 1992, I guess, or 1993. And, you know, being a med student, him being a senior attending, I said, geez, I'm not an orthopedic surgeon. How could I know what the worst problem in orthopedic surgery is? Why don't you tell me what the worst problem is and I'll sit here and take notes. And he said, no, I asked the questions, you know, what's the worst problem? I said, if you're going to back me into a corner, make me answer this question that I don't really have any firsthand experience with, it would be that I think you're leaving half of the good ideas out of the conversation. And he didn't have any idea what I meant. And so he asked me to clarify. And I said, well, you know, this program, I don't think has ever graduated a woman. And many programs at that point hadn't. And if there are no women here, then half of the good ideas aren't being engaged with. And that can't be good for us, and it can't be good for our patients. And, you know, I don't know why that is. When I became a resident, I found out why it was. I mean, it was porn in the call rooms back then. I mean, it was still a pretty bad time. And there was a woman in the program, you know, a year or two behind me, and she wound up basically dropping out. It was pretty inhospitable.
I think that's a great story because you were thinking about it before anyone else was. And I think the work you've done to bring these issues to light through CORE, through your work with RJOS, is really quite wonderful and unique in a way that, you know, there are other people doing it, but I think that number is very small, particularly maybe not in the early 90s.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there were people then who seemed enlightened on the subject. I mean, our department chair at that time, I think, wanted things to be better, you know, and I think he, you know, he was a father of daughters and I think he cared. I mean, I know he cared, but it takes more back then as now, it takes more than one man, even a person in a position of leadership. And, you know, culturally that place at that time, you know, wasn't there yet. I think it's better now.
Yeah, I think it's such a good point. And I think changing culture is like the hardest thing to do in general, whether it's women, diversity, all of our, you know, initiatives to move the field forward so that our group of physicians looks like the patients that we are treating. I mean, there's numerous studies showing that that's always better. But how do we make these two things match?
Yeah, you know, during the Me Too thing, you know, one thing really struck me and wound up writing a little bit about this was, you know, while that had to happen for all the reasons that it did, and, you know, the world is a better place that it happened, it had some revenge effects, you know, unintended consequences, right? That, you know, and one of them was that men were a lot less willing to be alone in a room with a woman you know, not a good class of men, in my opinion, but enough of them that it mattered, you know, because we can't solve the problem of sponsorship and mentorship for young women in our specialty with the women who are in our specialty. There aren't enough of them. And so it's going, you know, we're going to need men who are willing to say that this matters and not use the Me Too thing as an excuse to only mentor young men or to mentor young women differently than we might mentor young men. I remember being struck by how many men were uneasy about getting involved in the lives of women during that stretch of time.
Yeah, I have not thought about that, but I think that's a really good point. It brought to light some issues that maybe were hovering under the surface, but no one wants to talk about it out loud. And even now, I don't think people want to talk about them, but someone decided they were important enough to be said. So we've talked about all of these kind of tough topics, but you know, one thing I'd like to know is, what does it mean to you to have won the He for She Award, which is, you know, arguably one of our most prestigious awards at Ruth Jackson?
Well, I was very moved, you know, and surprised. Well, everybody sort of says this, you know, and it's become sort of a cliche, but I would say humbled, you know, you know, because I could think of so many people who have done so much more than I have. And so I was very, very touched by the award. It meant a great deal to me. It should probably be equally important to a person who raises sons as daughters, but we happen to have two girls. And, you know, watching people outside our family look after them from time to time, it helps me to understand the value of people other than one's parents looking out for you in the world. You know, so it reminded me really of how lucky I was to have gotten to, I don't want to say look after, but maybe help out some women at different career stages. You know, the beautiful things that people who wrote the nomination letters, which I didn't know about till afterwards. It was just very sweet because they were, I mean, some were, the people who I've worked with have been, you know, med students all the way through mid-career, and in some cases even, you know, contemporaries to me. I guess those aren't all mentorship things, but they're just, you know, one has a different perspective, you know. I'm not making a ton of sense, I guess, because I'm a little bit emotional about this. I was surprised and gratified, I guess, is the short answer.
No, it's so nice to hear. I think when we are, you know, honoring someone whenever someone is being honored, I'm sure everyone who wrote you a letter of support is, you know, happy that you feel as touched by the award as they felt by how you impacted their career, their life.
It was really as meaningful as any other recognition that I've ever gotten.
That's great. I think it sort of brings in a couple of things together, and this talking about culture change, and you talked a little bit about, you know, the people who take care of your kids that are not you or your wife, you know, it takes a village to move forward. So what do you think as the orthopedic village, what is our biggest challenge to improving diversity in our field? It's not women, of course, but it's not just women, it's people of color. You know, we are all looking to make this a more diverse workforce so we can look like the patients that we're taking care of, no matter where we are in our country or in other countries.
Yeah, I don't have a quick solution for that. If I did, I'd have shared it. I think that organizations are gradually realizing that you can't bolt on diversity efforts, you sort of have to bake them in. And so we can't solve this with the kind of fig leaf, like one more DEI committee. I think we really it has to be addressed by people who are at all of the different levels of leadership of the organizations that we care about have to share this as a value. You know, it's really about the people agreeing to change the structures. And that's doable. But it takes seemingly more commitment than our specialty has had so far. And I hope that that changes, but the rate of change isn't as fast as it needs to be. I remember seeing a paper a couple of years ago. I probably should have looked it up before this interview, but somebody traced out the trend line, how many years it would take before, you know, the proportion of women in orthopedic surgery is similar to that. And it was, I don't know, two or three centuries or some crazy number. So that can't be the answer. That can't be the answer. So that's the structural level. You know, we've got to change the way we're approaching it. And the people who are charged with making those decisions all have to agree that it's worth changing and needs to change. And the other half is this, I don't want to trigger the bleep for swearing, but this sexist stuff has to stop.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I'd be curious to know. I'm not sure if this has ever been discussed amongst, you know, people in different fields, but, you know, some surgical specialties like general surgery is like 50-50 now, like women and men are, and they're much more, I think they're otherwise more diverse. I'm not sure exactly on the numbers, but I'd be curious to know what has changed there that isn't changing for us.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. When, you know, we receive a lot of papers at CORE that I get to read that sort of benchmark this, and we don't publish most of them because there's no sense publishing a paper every 3 months saying there still aren't very many women in orthopedic surgery. You know, it's at a certain point, it's not interesting reading.
No, just, we know we have to know right. What's next, you know?
Right. Right. So, but in the ones that we publish, I have occasionally sent the authors back to the well and say, tell you what, why don't you go look at this and the other specialties and see, what have they done differently than what we've done? They haven't come back with much, right? You know, which is why we're still where we are. I'm not being terribly helpful on an important set of points. You know, I think that, you know, it's mattered to me as somebody who nominally runs a journal or works at a journal. And so we've tried to do things here, right? So what are the things that we've done? You know, we've tried to make sure that we're connected to the leading professional organization for women, which is Ruth Jackson. We did that early. We've tried to have a symposium regularly. We've done it every other year since I've been here. I think we're working on the sixth one now since I've been here, on sex and gender and diversity and disparities. We've covered that formally in a symposium every other year since I've been here, but really tried to make sure that everybody knows that the intake manifold for those papers is open year-round every year, not just during a symposium. This isn't, again, something that is bolted on. We're trying to, you know, bake this in. You know, we've looked at the structure of what we do and you know, how can we make the masthead representative of all the different things that it ought to be representative of amongst people who want to participate? I can't make people want to participate who don't want to, and I can't make people who aren't very good at a job better at it. I can only point them to resources, but there certainly are, you know, ample opportunities to do better there across our specialty, and we've tried to model that as best we can. We have covered in the conversation section people of many different backgrounds to show what the contributions are of people from many different backgrounds. We've featured the work of authors in the spotlight section of many different backgrounds because we want to show that good work comes from lots of different kinds of places. You know, the editorial pages, you know, it's a topic that I've returned to in different ways many times over the 11 or whatever years it's been since I've been doing this. I'm not saying I've got it right. I don't. But what I want to show is that it takes a sort of sustained enthusiasm even to make little changes, you know, because I don't think we've changed the world here at CORE. I'm not so immodest as to say that. I mean, we haven't changed our specialty, but, you know, I think perhaps we've created a place that I hope, you know, women find welcoming to work, and women are enthusiastic to send their manuscripts, you know, knowing that there's a team here that cares about their experiences. So I'm not sure if that's quite an answer to your question, but it's the best I got.
I think hearing your perspective is why we came to have this conversation. I don't think anyone has all the answers, but even just a snippet of someone's perspective can hopefully inspire another person to say, you know, this matters, and it matters to me. So I'm going to make this change in the way I mentor people or who I mentor or how I sponsor people. I think that's what we kind of have to hope for. It's just one person at a time. And even though that's going to be a slow change, eventually that will have exponential growth. And I think that is the first step, which it's already in motion, but it's the first step to changing the culture that keep some people away, keep women away, keep people of color away, whatever, you know, it may be.
Well, as Granny used to say, from your mouth to God's ears. I hope that we are going to see that kind of growth. So far we haven't, but I hope that we do.
No, I hope we do as well. So I want to end all of these conversations with the same question. And that question is, what advice would you give your younger self? What's the one piece of advice you wish someone had told you when you were 18, 20, 5 years old? I don't know. Whatever age.
Yeah, it's funny you should ask that. You know, this is, I'm kind of getting the chance to do that now because my kids are that age where I wish somebody, you know, had intervened in my life in certain ways, you know, but without getting overly philosophical, you know, it's a concept of impermanence that everything changes. And this is good for two things. One is if you're suffering because something is not working out the way you hope, it gives you sort of the hope that it's not always going to be suffering like this. And on the flip side is it maybe keeps you from clinging to those wonderful awards or accolades when they come along, that, you know, those are the good days, but don't get too hung up on that. You know, you're just a regular guy and, you know, the good may be followed by a dip, but also the dip, you know, day follows night. And so if I wish that I could, or that, you know, if I could have found somebody to help me work a little bit on that resilience piece, I would have had an easier time starting out in surgery, because to me, that was the hardest thing was, you know, if I operated on somebody and they didn't do well, or if I made a bad decision, or I made a technical error, or if I didn't do anything wrong, but things still didn't work out well, all of those things happen as part of surgery. And I never really came to adapt to that in any sort of healthy, constructive way. If I had it to do over again, or if it would be possible to help people to think about those things at the beginning of a career rather than in the middle or at the end, maybe that would have been made life a little bit happier along the way. Not that things are unhappy. I wouldn't want to end this on a down note. I actually love my job and have been privileged to take care of the patients I've taken care of and mentor the, you know, been involved with the lives of people at Rich Jackson and elsewhere. But so I wouldn't want to end on a heavy note. But, you know, actually what I do every day is pretty terrific fun. But you got me thinking about what would I do different 30 years ago, or what do I wish I, you know, you can't really go back, but that's an example.
I think you can always build resiliency no matter how old you are, but I think the sooner you start building it, it will grow, which is important.
For sure. And
so I think that's a great piece of advice.
Yep. Day follows night.
Day follows night. I like it. Well, Dr. Leopold, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the Ruth Jackson podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and I'm sure all of our listeners will really appreciate all of your insight.
Well, what a joy it's been to meet you, Dr. Tedesco. Thank you for the invitation.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you're interested in learning more about some of the programs offered by the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society or getting involved in our committees, check out our show notes. On another note, the RJOS annual meeting is coming up. Please join us in San Francisco on February 12, 2024. In addition to the annual meeting, RJOS is hosting its first annual research day to showcase the research of our membership. Visit rjos.org/events to learn more. Until next time, I'm your host, Liana Tedesco, and this was the RJOS podcast.